The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is the best way to keep on top of all the news out of China, especially if you subscribe to our email newsletter, SubChina Access, or check out subchina.com for all the original reported stories, op-eds, great regular columns, and our growing range of videos and podcasts. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you today from my home in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I've not made any secret of the fact that it's been pretty rough for me of late, what with U.S.-China tensions continuing to rise, even after the election of Joe Biden and, you know, with anti-Asian hate inseparable, really, from the Sinophobia that's gripped so much of the country. I imagine that many of the listeners to this show share my despondency. Well, folks, I've got something that might just make you feel better, at least for 90 minutes, with a warm afterglow that will keep your mood elevated for that long again, at least. So as long as you stay off Twitter and don't look at the news. So on April 16th, PBS's Great Performances will air the documentary Beethoven in Beijing, which tells the story of the Philadelphia Orchestra's long and very close relationship with China from the first concerts that the orchestra under the legendary conductor Eugene Ormandy played there in 1973 up to nearly the present, to 2019. The film looks at the orchestra's role in popularizing classical music in China, as well as China's role in revitalizing not only the Philadelphia Orchestra, but perhaps it's not too much of a stretch to say in revitalizing classical music in the United States. I cannot recommend this documentary more highly. And today on Cynica, I have three wonderful guests, all deeply involved with the documentary, to talk with me about this fantastic film. First, I'd like to introduce Jennifer Lin, a veteran journalist who was with the Philadelphia Inquirer for many years and reported from China and from other countries and territories in Asia. In 2017, she published the book Shanghai Faithful, Betrayal and Forgiveness in a Chinese Christian Family, about her own family in Shanghai and their experience during the country's tumultuous modern history. Jennifer was one of the directors of Beethoven in Beijing, and we are delighted that she could take time to join us. Congrats, Jennifer, on this truly touching and very heartwarming film, and welcome, Jennifer, to Cynica.
Well, thank you, Kaiser, for having us on your show. It's a real honor.
Well, honor is all mine. Sheila Melvin is someone I've had the pleasure of knowing for, a couple of decades or more. And she spent many years at the U.S.-China Business Council, which is a fantastic organization. She went on to become one of the most prolific and highly regarded writers on culture in China, which is something that people just do not write about enough, publishing in all the major newspapers and magazines. Along with her husband, who I will introduce shortly, she co-authored the excellent Rhapsody in Red, How Western Classical Music Became Chinese, as well as a book entitled Beethoven in China. Both Sheila and her husband are interviewed in the documentary, and she was a script advisor to it. Sheila, welcome to Cynica. Great to see you.
Thank you, Kaiser. Great to be here.
And finally, Cai Jingdong is one of the great bridge builders in classical music between China and the United States. Born in Beijing, he had a truly storied childhood that includes, as I trust he's going to share with us, a memorable encounter with Madame Jiang Qing herself. He came to the U.S. in the 1980s, and in 1989, he was actually selected to study with famed conductor Leonard Bernstein at the Tanglewood Music Center. He has been a conductor at the Cincinnati Symphony. He spent time in my hometown of Tucson, Arizona, at the University of Arizona, where my mother bestowed the dubious honor of godson on him. And then in 2004, he joined Stanford University as director of orchestral studies. He conducted the Stanford Symphony Orchestra for 11 years and is now director of the U.S.-China Music Institute, professor of music and arts at Bard College, and associate conductor of the orchestra now. He's also a producer of the film. Jin Dong, welcome back to Seneca.
Thank you, Kaiser. Thank you so much. So happy to see you.
Yeah, it's wonderful to see you. Thank you, first of all, to all three of you for this much-needed ray of hope and sunshine in this season of darkness, gloom, and despair. Have you guys, I don't know if you've all been feeling it too, and I don't know if your work on this film has been as much of a salve as it's been for me. And if so, next time, get me involved.
Yeah, we have been, I think that's 5 or 6 years, right,
Jennifer? Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway. Jennifer, let me start with asking you about the genesis of this project and the relationship between this film and the book, you know, that Sheila and Jin Dong wrote for Penguin that came out in 2015. I mean, your connection to Philadelphia, having written for The Enquirer for so long, is obvious enough. But how did you and your co-director, Sharon Mullally, decide on this particular approach and this particular angle to tell this story?
Sure. Well, I had kind of a personal window into this story. My father's from Shanghai, and he literally left Shanghai on one of the last boats out. And he took us back to Shanghai in 1979, and we were able to meet all of our relatives for the first time. One of the cousins I met was my cousin Julia, and she was a few years older than me. And Julia, in 1962, entered the Shanghai Conservatory. Hmm. She wanted to be a concert pianist. And of course, in 1966, you know, her world turned upside down, and it was really a horrible time for the family. And the Lin family, their home was raided, her piano was carted off, they destroyed all of her Deutsche Grammophon albums, burned her sheet music, and there was one night where she was caught playing Mozart at an uncle's house. And the next day, the Red Guards at the conservatory basically beat her and tried to break her hands with a ping pong paddle.
Ugh.
In 1973, which is the year the Philadelphia Orchestra went to China, they performed in Beijing and Shanghai. And my cousin, because she was at the time working as a pianist for the Shanghai Lyric Opera Company, she actually got a ticket. And so she heard Ormandy and the fabulous Philadelphians, as they're known locally, she heard them. And I remember her telling me that it was like being in the desert and getting a long drink of water. She really, really remembered that concert and cherished that moment. So I kind of held on to that image and that notion. And then it was in 2008, Kaiser, that the newspaper sent me to China to cover an anniversary concert marking the 35th anniversary of the tour.
Oh, wow.
And they held it in the same dingy Hall of Nationalities, and they performed the exact same program. And they sent me because I knew my way around China, not because I knew classical music. And so when I was covering the concert and interviewing people as they were coming and going, I was really struck by the degree of nostalgia that the Chinese people had towards this orchestra. And so I just always felt like, you know, I should have known this, but I didn't. And so, you know, it occurred to me that this was kind of a chapter in U.S. history that was kind of fading. And I also thought that it would make a great movie, that this was really a story that should be seen and heard and not just read about, the legacy of the Philadelphia Orchestra and kind of what has happened since 1973. So that was kind of the catalyst. You know, when I left the newspaper 5 years ago, I wanted to try my hand at other types of storytelling, and I thought this would be a great subject for a documentary. So I pitched the orchestra, and it took them a little while, but they finally agreed, and I partnered with a guy named Sam Katz.
Mm-hmm.
He's in Philadelphia, and he's one of the producers of the film and the executive producer. And so the orchestra then gave us the green light. So the first time we actually traveled with them to China was 2016.
Oh, okay, okay. But you used quite a bit of archival footage. You used a lot of, I mean, it's
yes,
pretty amazing. So the film itself jumps around quite a bit in time. I mean, it's bookended between the first concerts that are played by the Philadelphia Orchestra in 73
and a more recent, I guess it was 2019, performance of the orchestra under its conductor, Yannick Nézet-Séguin. But maybe we could try and take this on more chronologically. So maybe we could set the scene first and give a kind of abridged short history of classical music in China prior to 73. Sheila, maybe I can start by asking you about the pre-49 high water mark for European classical music in China. I mean, had it taken root at all during the Republican period, just in the relatively cosmopolitan enclaves like Shanghai, or how well known was Western classical music at the time?
Yes, well, Western classical music was first introduced to China starting in the 1600s, and even earlier by missionaries, Catholic and Christian missionaries who used music as a form of worship, and also brought instruments to the Chinese emperors because they were seen as impressive gifts from Europe. They were technologically advanced. China didn't have keyboard instruments and the West did. So it started going in that route, and it very, very slowly took root. But I'd say it really took off more when the Shanghai Symphony was founded, which was back in 1879, which is even earlier than the Boston Symphony. It's earlier than a lot of the great American orchestras. And then again, it was performed mostly for the foreign community. But by the 1900s, early 1900s, 1920s, Chinese audiences were allowed to go in. And the first Chinese musician joined the Shanghai Symphony in 1927. So by then, it did have fairly firm roots. And another angle was through military bands. So they would also sometimes play orchestral music. But a lot of the Chinese warlords had military bands. So there was band music and there was orchestral music in the major cities.
So they had heard a little bit of Sousa before, the orchestra actually played Stars and Stripes. Yeah. That's interesting. I'm curious, though, you know, what was it that they had? I mean, I just remember in the beginning of the film talking about how Chopin and Liszt were on the naughty list, as it were. Just now Jennifer told us about her cousin having her hands almost broken with ping pong paddles over playing Mozart. It seems like some composers were verboten and others were sort of still allowed. How did they draw the line? Was it just sort of the arbitrary tastes of people like Jiang Qing?
Well, basically, I mean, when 1949 came along, when the communists won the revolution, triumphed, and the People's Republic was founded, there was a big debate over Western classical music, whether or not it was bourgeois and it should be thrown out, or whether it could serve the needs of the workers, soldiers, and people. And it was decided that it could serve the needs, but it kind of had to be signified and adapted. And there were certain so Chinese composers started composing their own music, and certain Western composers were still permitted. And one of them was Beethoven, because Beethoven was seen as a revolutionary even in his own lifetime, and also because he was very popular in the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union was instrumental in setting up all these orchestras, opera houses, conservatories, and they liked Beethoven. So that sort of music was permitted up until the beginning of the Cultural Revolution. But the more sort of impressionistic bourgeois music like Debussy was not permitted. It was never performed as much.
I see. But what about some of the more avant-garde stuff that was coming out of what would become the Soviet Union, or, you know, in the case of some of these composers, was already the Soviet Union? I mean, many of my favorite Eastern European composers, I hope that they were still being played in China. I mean, you know, your Prokofiev and your Stravinsky, was that considered too weird for China?
Well, I think you can, one way, like Sheila said, and the other way you measure it, it's by politics. Any composers related with nationalism and mostly will be allowed to, music can be allowed to play in China.
So like Dvorak would be okay?
Dvorak will be okay. And Chopin, you know, because he always think he is, his heart in Poland and this. Anyone, you know, you can find some really that's kind of nationalistic stories, then their music actually will get to be played. And I think for the Soviet Union's composer, I don't think China is very keen yet, because they, you know, when I was in music school in China, after Cultural Revolution, basically we only learn music up from Bach or after Bach and before Debussy. So that's period, you know, so that's, and so the anyone beyond that, we just don't have it. We never really have the information to learn them.
Jindu, while we're on you, tell us a little bit about your own experiences as a young aspiring composer during the waning years of the Cultural Revolution, and about this encounter that you had with Jiang Qing that I alluded to when I introduced you. Tell us about that. Those are some amazing stories.
Well, you know, I loved music when I was little. I always try to look at our window, see other people are playing Chinese instruments. So I grab an erhu to play for a little. And then, you know, I find the violin. The reason because during the Cultural Revolution, the first few years, there's no school. And my father think, you better not to get on the street. What do you like to do? I said, what about play some music? He find a used violin from a dime shop. You know, it's so I started to play this this violin, and I studied for myself, then find a teacher to study. So that's how I start music, start with Western instrument. So that's what I want to say is even during the Cultural Revolution, Mozart was forbidden, right? Beethoven's forbidden, but the instrument you can play. And you mentioned Jiang Qing, your mom's wife. She actually loved Western music. She liked Copeland's Red Pony, and she loved Rachmaninoff, if you talk about Soviet Union's composers. So, and then, you know, so I studied the violin, but you're only allowed to play the etudes and the revolution, join the revolution propaganda troop, what you call 宣传队. So you play the modern operas, and you play revolutionary dance, and whatsoever. So that's in 1975, just before the Cultural Revolution finished. And there's one situation, I was leading an orchestra. And so I started to conduct, learn to conduct. So, and that year we were invited to the Great Hall of People to play for, it's a March 8th, you know, International Women's Day.
Right.
So play for the wives of the ambassadors. So we went there, actually, Madame Mao, Jiang Qing was there because she's the leading figure. So on that thing, so we played the revolutionary dance and the music. So after that, we had good food. That's what I remember.
The food, of course. You know, there are these fantastic animation sequences, Jennifer, that you use in the film every time you've got people telling stories from their past, like when Jin Dong tells a story about listening to Beethoven for the first time. I love those. I mean, that was such an inspired decision to use that animation. So, you know, when Tan Dun talks about his train ride from Hunan, you know, hiding in the bathroom. I don't want to spoil it. And Jin Dong, when you talk about that story of you listening to Beethoven for the first time, those were delightful, Jennifer. Whose idea was that?
So I didn't want animation.
Oh, really?
But my co-director, Sharon Mullally, she was advocating for it. And so it's funny how we found our animator. His name is Jacob Rivkin. But we literally, Sharon finally brought me around that animation would be good. And we literally Googled Chinese brush style animation. And we came upon Jacob, who happens to be in Philadelphia.
Wow.
He teaches animation both at Penn and Rutgers. And I just adore the animation in the film because he was able to convey concepts and ideas and memories in a way that we could never do just with film. Oh, and the other thing I forgot to mention about Jacob and talk about, you know, fate. He was a Fulbright in Nanjing. So when I told him, okay, we have to create like a lavatory inside a Chinese train for this one scene involving Tan Dun, I didn't really have to explain it. You know, he knew exactly.
He'd been on trains.
Yeah. And the wonderful Jin Dong sequence, which is one of my favorite parts of the whole film. When I told him it was in a Shiyuan, he knew what it looked like. He knew how to envision these scenes in China. So, yeah, I mean, I think without the animation, we would not have been able to convey certain anecdotes as well as, you know, certain concepts.
You know, I think that if you hadn't told me that it was a guy named Jacob, I would have assumed it was a Chinese animator. I mean, I think he really got it. It felt so just authentic. It was fantastic. You have this remarkable tape of Nixon and Kissinger actually breaking the news by phone to Eugene Ormandy that the Philadelphia Orchestra had been invited to China. That was amazing. There's all sorts of great archival stuff in there. But there was also a backstory here, right? Ormandy, as I understand it, had been lobbying to get the Philadelphia Orchestra to China from the moment that a thaw was detectable. I mean, he was pushing this, right?
Fiercely. He was pushing it fiercely. I actually have a book coming out on Beethoven in Beijing, focusing just on the 1973 tour. And what I found out, Kaiser, is he was actually lobbying in 1971 when he was reading the paper about the ping pong team going to China. And he was sitting with the manager of the orchestra, Boris Sokolov, and he said, "Boris, how do we get an invitation to China?" And they're like, "I don't know." So they called the White House, and the White House said, "Well, you have to approach the nearest embassy." So the orchestra actually rode away to the Canadian embassy, and they never replied. But then Ormandy kind of worked all of his political contacts. So like Senator Hugh Scott and, you know, all of these Republican bigwigs were really lobbying for him. And then Nixon really liked him. I mean, he received the Presidential Medal from Nixon, and Nixon tells the story about listening to the Philadelphia Orchestra albums as a kid growing up. So there was this affinity already between Ormandy and Nixon.
I had no idea. That's who would have ever thought that Nixon was a classical music aficionado. You know, but Sheila, when Zhang Qing and the Gang of Four first heard that they were coming and they were planning on playing the Fifth Symphony, they were not happy about that because, you know, that's all about fate, and good Marxists, you know, they don't believe in predestined outcomes, but in mankind forging its own destiny. They hinted strongly, though, that they wanted the Sixth instead, the pastoral. I guess Ormandy wasn't pleased with that, though. Can you explain why? What did he have against the Sixth, the pastoral symphony?
I think he just didn't think it showed off the best qualities of the Philadelphia Orchestra. Because you know, they could sound so big and so bold.
Right.
And so I think he just didn't particularly like it. It wasn't the best way to showcase his orchestra. But there was a backstory to that, because when Kissinger made one of his visits to China in 1973, Zhou Enlai had said, "Hey, he's German. We should play Beethoven for him." So he got the Central Philharmonic to give him basically a private concert. But there was a big behind-the-scenes debate about he said to the conductor, Li Dolun, "What do you play best? What Beethoven?" And he said, "Beethoven's Fifth." But then the Gang of Four got involved, and they said what you just said. "Oh, no, the Fifth is about fatalism." And so then Li Dolun, the conductor, said, "Well, what about the Third?" And the Gang of Four said, "No, that's about Napoleon," because Beethoven had originally dedicated it to Napoleon and then crossed it out. And then they said, "Okay, well, what can we play?" And the Gang of Four said the Sixth. It's about peasants, because it's a pastoral. So that sort of became the go-to Beethoven after that debate.
So Ormandy, actually, Jennifer, his reaction to watching or to listening as the crowd, this is in the film, applauded so tepidly. That was really funny. And it was something I've also experienced when first playing concerts in China, although in my case, the reaction probably was genuinely tepid. This would have been kind of frightening. Jingdong, you were there. Is that how audiences used to respond? I mean, that was really, you know, the most enthusiasm they could summon up, just sort of clapping.
Yes. Wildly. You know, I still remember in 1979, that's quite a few, some years after that. You know, when you go to a concert, you can hear the pin drop. And it's very, very quiet. And after concert, if you can hear some clapping, then you're lucky. And usually we were trained just not to doing that. So it's very natural. It's never really react to anything excited. And if you reacting anything excited, you can be in trouble. So that's in our culture.
Well, I've definitely seen, I've been to symphonies in China where people will start clapping between movements and then everyone will turn around and glare at them.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But the thing is, you know, it doesn't mean you're not appreciated. It's even more inside of you. You know, like I mentioned, in 1979, I went to the Berlin Philharmonic with Karajan conducting. It did a play in the, you know, like 8,000 Colosseum, people Colosseum. So that's it. What I said, even you, the music start, it's like you can hear a pin drop. It's so quiet. And after concert, you don't hear this kind of a storming applauding. You just hear, but everyone enjoyed. Everyone just look at each other. Everyone just so amazed by what kind of sound they heard, and that kind of sound they never heard before.
So there's this amazing scene, though, where Eugene Ormandy visits the rehearsal studio. I guess it's the Central Conservatory. The Chinese musicians are all just, you know, absolutely nervous. Then I can't remember who it was, but one of the American musicians is talking about this and says that within minutes, once Normandy actually starts conducting, they start sounding like the Philadelphia Orchestra. That seems to suggest to me that the raw talent was really there. Talk about the state of classical musicianship in China at the time, Jindong. How good were they? I mean, what was missing? Was that all that raw potential was already there? Is that fair?
Well, during the Cultural Revolution, it's about 10 years, so you're not allowed to play classical music, but that doesn't mean people are not practicing. Right. People practicing in secret, you know, and that's why after the Cultural Revolution, there like thousands of people just came out to try to enter the Central Conservatory. So that's what I mean. In the Cultural Revolution, people are practicing, and people basically still have attached to the classical music.
Yeah. Well, that relates to the persistent knock that we hear against East Asian musicians, not just Chinese, but all East Asian musicians. We've heard this for decades, or at least used to anyway. They're technically proficient, sure, but somehow they lack this capacity for emotional expression. I always found this to be, you know, essentialist nonsense. I mean, it's a piece with the whole, you know, East Asians are robotic, emotionless automatons. Some of the musicians that you feature in the film, though, obviously they suffer maybe a surfeit of emotionalism, if anything. Long Long, for example. But Sheila, do you see this as changing now? I mean, what do people say now about, you know, musicians from East Asia? Do you still hear this? Are we moving beyond this idea of Asians as soulless machines?
No, I think the bias still exists. I mean, they're technically proficient, but they're not musical, whatever that means. You know, this idea that because the European music people are performing didn't come from China and therefore they somehow don't have the same connection to it, I think is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, Beethoven's roots are so deep in China. This is a composer people literally died for. Beethoven is as much a composer of China as he is of Germany. And I think, you know, you don't see that many conductors from East Asia. It's changing a little bit. But, you know, if you look at the youth orchestra system in the United States, you'll see so many Chinese conductors, so many Chinese kids in the youth orchestras. And then slowly, as you get higher, 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 there's not nearly as many. The percentages drop significantly. So I think, unfortunately, that bias is still here.
Really, that is a pity.
Well, I think that also you can say the view, you can say Chinese people don't have the Western concept view of classical music.
Unpack that a bit for me.
Somehow the Western classical music throughout the history is really the criticism is very important in Western classical music development. The criticism about the composers, about pieces, and then the composer will write an even better piece. And but in China, they really never had that control. But music is a living art. You know, if you have a piece of music, it's not music. Music only when it becomes sound, it becomes music. So which means the music really rely on performers to finalize it. And that's why when play Beethoven 250 years, you still hear a brand new idea of a new interpretation. So I think an Asian people or a Chinese people can achieve that by the new ideas to play classical music.
You know, one of the things I really loved about the film is that how it features quite a number of Chinese musicians and composers and you know, exposes us to quite a few of them. One of the more famous, of course, is Long Long. Jennifer, Gary Graffman gives us a little recitation about how his own lineage goes, you know, from this student-teacher connection all the way back to Beethoven himself through his own teacher, Isabel Vengerova, back to Czerny, who studied, you know, directly under Beethoven. Graffman taught Long Long. That was super cool. I came away with this very, very impressed with Long Long for a lot of reasons. What is he like to work with as a subject of a film?
I interviewed him in 2016 when he was performing in Philadelphia with the Philadelphia Orchestra, and also in he was touring with them in China that time. But in between the rehearsals, he also did one of these student events where he brings together like 101 pianists and they all play together on the stage at Temple University. So what's really impressive about Lang Lang is his work with his foundation. So there are six schools, public schools in Philadelphia, where he's made grants to them in order for the schools to have music programs, piano programs, and he provides the electric keyboards and the curriculum. So, I mean, he's you know, in Philadelphia, he's very much, he's an endearing character.
Yeah, you know, that's a theme that threads through the whole thing, is the importance of musical education from grade school on. I mean, I know personally, I benefited from that enormously. I actually am still in touch with my grade school music teacher, Mrs. Klingensmith, if you're out there listening. Many of her other students who are now like, you know, in their 40s and 50s, all they remember, you know, her method of teaching sight singing and, you know, of teaching rhythm and all the songs that we learned, the very silly ones that I sang to my kids when they were young. There is this very touching scene where you talk to one of the grant recipients, the principal at Thomas Holm Elementary, Principal Crystal Roy Gill, who gets that grant from Lang Lang. And I thought that was just a great thing to include. And it was just very, very touching. What's the state of music education in China? I mean, my sense was always that they identify you young and then you go off to a specific, you know, you start on a music track, and that your general, just your ordinary high school student, they're not necessarily exposed to it very much, or they have the sort of de rigueur piano or violin lessons when they're young, but not many of them sort of hold it close off into college or whatever.
Well, music education, I think, especially when you talk about classical music in China, right? For Chinese parents, they see this very important. And anywhere, you know, even in this country, you can see the major city youth orchestras, probably 80% of the kids are Asians, and maybe 90% of those Asians are Chinese. So the parents really think the music education and to learn Western instrument can help the kids set up discipline, and also can help them with a broad, you know, thinking of the creativity and so on. So it's very important. I think also from the government point of view of those days, they are also really strongly to promote arts education, including music education. Sheila probably
will
say something more. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it still plays a very major role. And, you know, there was a period, you know, in the 1980s, there was this great piano fever where people would actually invest in pianos, and multiple families would go in together to buy a piano so their child could have a chance to learn, because they didn't during the Cultural Revolution, or because they couldn't afford it too. And then later you have the Lang Lang phenomenon coming on, and many parents really push their children to be the next superstar. And there was tremendous pressure, you know, on kids to be a great star. But I think now it's becoming a little bit more normalized. There's an appreciation, still a tremendous value on musical education, both Western classical music and Chinese traditional instruments. Just that this is a very important part of being a well-rounded person and of having a full and complete education. But I think there's a bit less pressure, and there's more ensemble playing rather than just forcing kids to be soloists. I mean, there's still more tradition of, you know, you get a lot of violinists from China because it can be a solo instrument, and same with piano. But there's more bands in high schools, and there's more orchestras. So people are doing more of the traditional ensemble style playing that we do here in this country.
Oh, that's fantastic. Another couple of scenes that just really touched me. I'm sure this is one that really got everyone, and I couldn't imagine the film without it. But Booker Rowe, who is the second violinist in Philadelphia, at one point, so he gifts an entire set of the Mendelssohn string quartets to a couple who are also violinists in Beijing. And there's this, I mean, this is in 73. And there's this beautiful moment of reconnection many years later at near the end of the film, when you bring them back together at the National Performance Center.
Yeah, I'm glad you liked that scene.
Oh, I sure did.
The story behind it is, in 2016, it was our first time on tour with the Philadelphia Orchestra, and Jin Dong and I arranged a luncheon in Beijing. And we wanted Chinese musicians who had been in the Central Philharmonic during that rehearsal with Ormandy to get together with Philadelphia musicians who were still on tour and performing with the Philadelphia Orchestra. So we had a luncheon in Beijing, and the Chinese musicians were there first at the restaurant. And we had a lot of photographs from 73 all around the room. And I'll never forget it, because the Philadelphians came walking in. And as soon as Booker Rowe, he's a violinist, as soon as he walked into this room, this woman ran up to him and said, "You're the one, you're the man who gave me sheet music back in 1973. And she's going on and on and on. And our translator was trying to keep up with her. And Booker's like, you know, stunned and just trying to take it all in. But it meant so much to her, this gesture of, you know, she explained that all of her sheet music had been destroyed during the Cultural Revolution, right. And all of it was hand. You know, she had to recreate it all by hand. So to get printed, published material like that, it really meant a lot. So when we went back in 2017, I went to this couple's home. The husband was also a musician with the orchestra. And she pulled out the Mendelssohn music that Booker had given her, you know, 40 years ago. And we went with them to the concert. And before the concert, Booker was able to reconnect with them briefly. So, that was one of my favorite moments. And it just kind of grew out of this luncheon that we had, you know, our first tour.
It was lovely.
Yeah. Her husband was oboe principal, and he brought with him the oboe reed, the principal oboes the Philadelphia Orchestra gave to him in 1973. He still
kept
it.
He had six of them and gave away five and kept one.
Right, exactly. It's unbelievable.
Wow. It was really touching. I love how many of the orchestra's musicians had this long established history. I mean, David Booth, for example, talks about how this trip was, I guess it was the 2016 trip, or maybe another one, was his 12th already to China.
Yeah.
For the group that you filmed, you know, who went with Yannick Nézet-Séguin, were a lot of them multi-trip veterans of the orchestra?
So currently, there are only three musicians in the orchestra today who were there in 73.
Mm-hmm.
But when we started filming, there were six. And for the Chinese musicians, you know, from the Central Phil, they're just amazed that, you know, you can still be playing with
That's
a major
longevity,
orchestra.
Yeah.
I mean, David Booth was the youngest musician on tour in 73, and I think he was like 23 or something. But he still performs with the orchestra.
I love that. You know, the composer Tan Dun, who, of course, won the Oscar for Best Score for Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and wrote the soundtracks to Hero and The Banquet, and, of course, many other very, very famous compositions. He's featured also very extensively in the film, and Beethoven in Beijing focuses in on one of his compositions, which is Yu Shu, The Secret Writings of Women. And just for our listeners who've not, you know, you're just not going to want to miss this. If you aren't already familiar with it, it's this... Really, it's a multimedia performance. It features something which I hadn't seen before, which is a harpist as solo instrumentalist. She plays with the Philadelphia Orchestra, Elizabeth Heinen. Jindong, I've often thought of Tan Dun as being sort of to music what Xu Beihong was to painting, in that he had this kind of mastery over these two traditions, and he brings them together in a way that just doesn't feel forced or inorganic. It feels real. What do you think of Tan Dun's work? I mean, and what is he like as a person? Because he comes off just very, very wonderfully in this emotional and sentimental and warm.
Yeah. Well, you know, he himself would describe his music. He said, "I want to create organic music." Mm-hmm. It had to be organic. So that, because of that, you know, his music is very, very basically profoundly rooted in Chinese culture. So at where he grew up, you know, in Hunan, and so he reflected what he brought about people washing their clothes on the bank of the river, or, you know, they use the rock to do things and so on. So he implement all those into his music. He feels music is a live thing. It's a we, anything can be music. And so, like he created three concertos, you know, one is for water concerto, one is for paper, it's called paper concerto, another one for rocks. So it's a rock, you know, it's all a natural thing, and he just fascinated by what, you know, those things that people never really express on music. So he did it really successful. I think that's basically his idea of creating organic music. Of course, he also very care about Chinese traditional value, traditional culture. Like 3 years ago, he composed this Buddha Passion.
Right.
You know, the idea is it come from like a Bach, St. Matthew Passion or something. He went to Dunhuang, visited those places and paintings. He found out there's a profound insight there, and he dig out lots of tradition and made this new music.
There's another composer that you introduce us to, a young guy named, I guess his name is Gong Pengpeng. Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a composer in residence at the Shanghai Philharmonic. There's a piece, I was looking all over the internet to try to find some of his stuff that I could listen to, because there's a Three Kingdoms-inspired composition that you feature in the film, Jennifer, that includes him explaining like this trombone passage as, you know, the laugh of the villain Cao Cao. It's Symphony 10, Peking Fantasy, he calls it. What can you tell me about this composer? I mean, it sounds amazing, and he seems like just a super cool dude.
Well, Pengpeng was just a boy when he went to Juilliard. I think he was in fifth grade.
Oh, wow.
And he was in the pre-professional program. And I think his parents' aspiration was that he would be the next Long Long. So he was a piano student.
Oh, right.
With Veda Kaplinsky at Juilliard, who happens to be the wife of Herb Light, who's one of the people in our film. So, you know, Pengpeng studied at Juilliard, and by the time he got to like the college level of the conservatory, he decided he wanted to become a composer,
right?
Which did not go over big with his dad. It caused a lot of attention, but this is what he wanted to do. So Pengpeng's only 26. When he graduated from Juilliard, he told us he didn't have any strong intention to go back to China, but then he was offered this position with the Shanghai Phil. And as he says, you know, as a composer, you know, to be able to have a relationship like that, he couldn't turn it up. So he is now in Shanghai.
Well, I need to find some of his music, I mean, because that was just really compelling. I definitely want to check this out.
Kaiser, he also has a piece about Catcher in the Rye. I think he would love
that. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Not my favorite novel, but...
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, but it's a really interesting piece of music, actually. He does a great job.
See, that thing is what I want to say is, you know, there's a new generation of Chinese composers. Beyond Tan Dun, Chen Yi, Zhou Long, there's a new generation, like 20 or 30-something. Those people, you know, I think really we need to look into those composers. And in classical music world, around the world, people are looking for what is the next generation, what is the new, right? We have been playing dead people's music for so long. They're great, like Beethoven or Mahler, they're great. But same time, if you think about it back then, Beethoven's time, Mahler's time, they play contemporary music. So we need to have the music of our time. So what is the music of our time? So that's what we need to look at, you know, a part of it we need to look at China. If we say China can save classical music, I don't really, I'm not sure about if you just to say the classical music is a Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, or Bruckner. But if you go to China, you will see there are more new compositions, new operas being performed. So I will say China can contribute to the 21st century contemporary.
Revitalize it. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you often hear it remarked on how when you attend a classical concert in the U.S., the audience either has white hair or black hair, right?
Or blue hair.
Yeah, blue hair, exactly, blue hair. which is what I mean by white hair. I mean, your film features this very impressive National Center for the Performing Arts in Beijing. There are amazing concert halls already being, you know, built or being built in hundreds of Chinese cities. You also talk about that, you know, how every city has to have its opera house. Every city has to have its, it's fantastic. Meanwhile, you know, the Philadelphia Orchestra has to actually file for bankruptcy and they're in trouble. So, you know, I wonder how they're doing. First of all, how is the Philadelphia Orchestra doing now?
So it's important to note, Kaiser, they filed for Chapter 11 in 2011. So okay. It was a decade ago.
Okay.
And they actually came out of it in a year's time. So they're, before the pandemic, they were doing quite well in terms of rebuilding their endowment and reaching out to build new audience, as all orchestras are. So, you know, but the big difference, as you pointed out, is when you go to the NCPA or any concert hall in China, the audience, you'll see a lot of families, a lot of parents with little kids. And that's quite different than here in the United States.
Yeah.
Not just Philadelphia, but, you know, everywhere.
And one thing that I noticed is, I mean, at the end, you know, when they're playing the Ninth Symphony at the end, it really stuck with me, just the sheer excitement of the kids in the audience. They are literally on the edge of their seats. They're experiencing that rapturous transport that I am familiar with, you know, that, you know, my cohort growing up, we would feel that same intense pleasure at listening to music. Uh-huh. It's such a great thing to see, among, you know, this new cohort of Chinese people. It was one of the things because you know, the film ended on just such a powerful, wonderful note that I was, you know, I was walking on a cloud for hours after the first time I watched it. And then I watched it again just the other day.
Kaiser, you're the perfect viewer.
Okay, yeah, I confess. It's not going to do the same thing for everyone. But, you know, I needed it like nobody else.
Right.
I mean, boy,
But there are two scenes in that final moment where there's a little girl and she's literally sitting on the edge of her seat and sitting up straight. And then there's a little boy who's conducting the music. And it's just, you know, there's an energy there.
Yeah.
The great catches, yeah.
So, I mean, I can't help but think that, you know, maybe there's some truth to this idea that China is going to save, if not save, you know, to revitalize, to reinvigorate classical music. And you know, not just China, obviously, but the rest of East Asia. I think that, because it's been so frustrating for me as somebody who, you know, comes from the rock idiom to just see how swallowed up rock ended up being by just this commercial, just sort of cynically turned pabulum. I mean, that's such a contrast with what I see happening in the world of classical music. It's actually super encouraging to see.
Yeah, I would say transform.
Yeah, transform. That's a good word. Yeah, transform is a good word.
I think that's probably the best. They're not going to save it. They don't need to save it. That's not their job. They're going to transform it and become, you know, a genuine contributor and propel the art form forward. I think that's China's role in classical music and in many other areas of society.
Like painting, right? Like we've seen with sculpture and painting with a lot of the modern Chinese, you know, artists. It's transforming.
Exactly.
And one of the really wonderful things is how Chinese artists like Tan Dun and Gong Pengpeng, who we were just speaking about, can draw on two traditions.
Yeah.
You know, they can draw completely on the Western tradition and they can draw completely on the Chinese tradition. And to me, that's a tremendous advantage that many Chinese artists have that, you know, Western artists don't, because we tend to be drawing on our own tradition. But they've absorbed the Western tradition so thoroughly and kept their own at the same time. And then you get this fantastic merger and all these new ideas coming out. And that's a great gift that China has. And we could have it too if we were more willing to absorb.
It's a natural biculturalism. Jennifer, Sheila, Jindong, thank you so much for taking the time to chat, for making this wonderful, wonderful film. I hope everyone gets a chance to see it. It's the 16th on PBS, Great Performances. That is its debut. If people miss it, will they be able to see it somewhere else?
Yes, it'll be streaming on PBS for a month afterwards, so they can catch it for the next month at least.
Yeah, some station actually show it in the different time, I think. Yeah, just looking for the local PBS station.
I have a special request. When we get to the recommendations section, I want all of you, if you can, to introduce us to some of the new composers that are coming out. We talked about these 20 and 30-something composers. So if you have any in mind and you want to drop their names during this, I would be just delighted, because I'm always looking for new music to get into. So that would be fantastic. But so let us move on to recommendations. First, a really quick reminder that if you like the work that we do with the Seneca Podcast and the other shows in the network, shows like our new China Stories and Stalwarts, like the Caixin Seneca Business Brief, then please show your support by subscribing to SubChina Access, our daily newsletter. Also, check out SubChina AM, which is brand new. It offers a quick 2-minute read of the big business stories from China put together by our new China-based business editor, Che Chang, and our U.S. team as well. On to recommendations. Jennifer, why don't you start us off? What you got for us?
Okay, I have a book and a band for you, Kaiser.
All right, a book and a band.
So the book is about Chief Justice John Marshall. And it's called John Marshall, the Final Founder. And it's written by Robert Strauss. And I'm halfway through it. It's a very breezy biography.
Oh, okay.
And Robert Strauss makes the argument that Marshall should be up on the mantle with the other founding fathers, you know, George Washington et al. And it's a book that's filled with a lot of, I didn't know that. Like, I didn't know that he was in Valley Forge with Washington.
Wow.
So that's my book recommendation. And since you requested a music recommendation, I'll offer an indie band called San Fermin. And they're out of Brooklyn. And one of the founder of the band, Ellis Ludwig Leon, is a classically trained musician from Yale. And the lead singer is Alan Tate, and he's going to be my son-in-law. So there's a bit of nepotism there.
That's okay.
They are a very good band. So if you're looking for some indie bands,
you're letting your daughter marry a worthless rock musician, a call pool rock musician, huh? That's
exactly.
Good. All right. Good for you. That's fantastic. Open-minded like that. My wife swore when she'd broken up with the drummer she was dating before we got together that she would never date another long-haired rock musician. And yet, here we are 18 years later. Yeah. All right, Sheila, you're up.
I think I'll go ahead and urge people to listen to some of Pompongong, because that viola concerto after Catcher in the Rye is on YouTube. It's easily accessible.
Okay.
And it even has, it explains, he's got subtitles going on at the bottom telling the part of the story that he's performing through music. I think it's really creative. It's a great piece of music, and it's a great example of the absorption of both cultures.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, no, I was so blown away by that guy. So I'm going to, as soon as we're done here, I'm going to check that out. Thanks, Sheila. Great recommendation. And Jindong.
Yes. Okay. I always encourage people to listen to contemporary music by living composers. You know, and in this case, I would recommend people to listen to composition by Zhou Long. Zhou Long is a composer. He is among the first class of the composition majors after the Cultural Revolution entered into the Central Conservatory of Music. You know, he's the same class as Tan Dun, Ye Xiaogang, Chen Yi, they all this from the same class. And then he came to America, went to Columbia, get a doctor's there, and then he started composing. What I like his music is really, his music is truly in the Chinese inspiration. And he really directly, you know, bring a Chinese folk song or any tune to reorchestrate it. He never do that. But the sound is so Chinese. And, you know, the topic he pick, the piece, it's really unbelievable. And a couple years ago, we collaborated. And when I was at Stanford, we were thinking to create a musical work to commemorate the Chinese railroad workers work in America to build the Transcontinental Railroad. So then we searched to see what we're going to do. Then we decided to do an oratorio. So then, you know, there are two people. It's who is writing the lyrics and who is writing the music. So lyrics, we found Su Wei, who is a really great Chinese writer, now teach at Yale. And then music, it came up with Zhou Long. So now so they composed the piece. It's called the Chinese called Tie Han Jin Ding, and the English name is called Man of Iron and the Golden Spike.
Ah, right.
So basically, it's oriental, 1 hour long music combined with orchestra, chorus, and solos. Because it's oratorio, it have some kind of losing stories. Like there's six solos, there's a mother and there's her two sons who work in the railroad, and the mother back in Guangdong, you know. So there's a scenery, and then there's American manager, right? Mm-hmm. So and his foreman. Daughter, his daughter kind of fell in love with one of the Chinese railroad workers. So there's a little bit of scene and a story, but mostly we really revisit this 150 years ago, how Chinese people came all the way from China and worked really to build this great railroad. From Nevada to Sacramento. This part of the Continental Railroad pretty much built by Chinese. And my friend Gordon Chang at Stanford.
Gordon Chang at Stanford.
I knew you were exactly. going to bring him in because it had the good Gordon Chang, exactly. but not the bad guy.
Yeah, Gordon, exactly. You know, he wrote extensively about this history, a phenomenon. And then we just say, he always say, we just keep doing this academic research, and I wish that more people would know it. That's the initial idea. We want to bring it on stage as an art form.
Send Kaiser the link. I think Kaiser would love this piece.
I'm sure I would now. So now, is it on YouTube or is it somewhere that I can see it?
It's on YouTube. But someone, I think someone secretly put on YouTube. But you can also get on from the BARD U.S.-China Music Institute website. We put
out. Oh, no, that's where I'll
so you
I'll
can actually get that.
I'll send you the link. And it was going to be performed in Shenzhen, Hong Kong, all this. It would have been fantastic. But then the pandemic came.
Yeah, we made the world premiere 2 years ago in Carnegie Hall. Then I brought the orchestra all the way from East Coast to come to Stanford, perform at Stanford. And then we already scheduled to perform in China, but because of the pandemic, we have to cancel it. But there's a plan in running. Yeah. So that piece, I would really recommend that people to listen.
That sounds amazing. And yeah, I'm really glad. I knew that you were going to bring up Gordon Chang.
Railroad, Gordon.
Stanford, talking about the Chinese-American experience,
great,
the railroads.
Yeah.
The good Gordon Chang, right?
Yeah.
Oh, those of you who are not familiar with him, I interviewed him as part of my California series last year. No, it was at the end of 2019. So check that out. It's a really, really fun interview. I am going to recommend a couple of long articles, one from March 19th in the New York Review of Books called A Day in the Life of Abed Salama by Nathan Thrall, and another of roughly the same length by the New Yorker writer Rafi Khachaturian called Surviving the Crackdown in Xinjiang, which just came out this last week. If you've read them both, you will understand why I pair them, both focusing on the experience of one individual, a Palestinian man named Abed Salama, whose young son is killed in a bus accident, and a Kazakh woman named Anar Sabit, who is detained and eventually sent to a re-education camp in her native Xinjiang in 2017. Both stories really kind of zoom out from these individuals to the macro picture of what's happening. Both feature, very sympathetic characters whose names, coincidentally, both have the initials A.S. It was really almost eerie how this happened, but I read them right one after the other, and it really set my mind to thinking about the many ways in which Israel and China, in Xinjiang in particular, have parallels. It's I know I'm probably going to get in trouble for having said that, but it's really important, I think, to understand and to start thinking about those parallels. Anyway. Thank you. I mean, I don't mean to end on a depressing note here after such an uplifting conversation. But thank you once again to Jennifer, to Sheila, and to Jindong. It's been such a pleasure speaking to you, and congrats on this just fantastic film. It was so great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kaiser. Thanks for having us all on.
Oh, what a delight. Yeah. Great to see you, Sheila.
I miss seeing you in person, Kaiser, one of these days.
It won't be too long now. Okay. I've got my first shot. I got my second one on the 17th.
All right.
Yeah, I always want to visit your mother. You know, I hope.
She's living, you know, in Walnut Creek, right? So she's got both her shots. As soon as you guys are, go see her. She'd be happy to see her.
Yeah.
Her errant godson.
Radical godson. Okay, bye.
All right, guys. All right, so just stick around for just 1 second. Don't close your, because it's got to upload your stuff. I'm going to go ahead. The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn, with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News, and make sure to check out all the shows in the Seneca Network. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.